now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Michael Schrat. Michael Schrat is a private pilot and a military aerospace historian. He has lectured across the country on the unique subject of mystery aircraft and classified propulsion systems buried deep within the military-industrial complex. A guest speaker at the Oshkosh Air Venture 2006-2007 event, the world's largest air show, Michael has developed a number of contacts which have had first-hand experience dealing classified black programs, including former United States Air Force pilots, retired naval personnel, and aerospace engineers that have maintained a top-secret SCI clearance. Michael currently works as a SolidWorks draftsman in Phoenix, Arizona. In an effort to expose government fraud, waste, and abuse, Michael devotes much of his free time researching aerospace technical documents, conducting interviews, and traveling to multiple university archives. As a concerned citizen, it is his belief that it is our constitutional obligation to question authority, demand an accounting of special access programs that bypass congressional oversight and public scrutiny. So without any further ado, Michael Schrat, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
James, thanks for having me on the program.
The pleasure is all ours, Michael. For the benefit of our listeners, could you tell us a bit about your background and how you got into all this?
I've just always been interested in aircraft. My father took me to the EAA air show for years, like 27 years straight. So I was very familiar with those type of aircraft that you would see at your air show. But I always had this keen interest on the planes that we don't know about, the secret planes that were tested at Area 51 and other secret locations like Air Force Plant 42, Palmdale. And that's what I really wanted to focus my attention on. So I just started interviewing engineers, test pilots, people who worked on these programs, started gathering reports and following up at libraries, as you mentioned in the intro there, and just started piecing this puzzle together. Bill Scott, who's the former Rocky Mountain editor of Aviation Week, he kind of categorized it as a 400-piece puzzle, and we only have 200 of the pieces, and we're trying to put that mosaic together. That's really our job as citizens, as taxpayers, to put this story together and maintain an important part of our national history.
The thing about the black programs, it's relevant right to everyone, whether they believe in UFOs or not, whether they believe in conspiracies or not, because so much of the money that's generated goes into this black hole in the SAP, special access programs, and right, there's no congressional overview. Can you tell the listeners exactly why we need to plug into this information and the critical nature of it? Because we're being deprived of information and technology that could be a benefit to everybody.
It's the propulsion systems that I think are at the heart of it, because if they could declassify those propulsion systems and let that trickle down to the commercial industry, we could revolutionize our entire airline industry, our entire cargo transport industry would be completely changed overnight. And it would take like pennies on the dollar to move things using this technology. But yet we're still chugging away in a 747, making these over-the-ocean flights only going 500 miles an hour. I mean, we're so far behind where we need to be. It could really be a revelation.
And for the benefit of listeners also, we see like a linear progression, at least what's allowed on the surface. Well, we go from cloth-covered biplanes, you know, as far as the wings are concerned, propellers, and then we start to go to the jets, and then the hypersonic aircraft. But in the deep black projects, it's been, you know, the concepts of electrogravitics, of electromagnetism, anti-gravity have been well understood for decades now.
Yep. And one thing I've put together here before we went on air is the U-2 spy plane first flew in 1955, and then fast forward to 2017, that's 62 years. Of those 62 years, we've only seen 10 black aircraft that were manned come into the white world. So I'll list them off here real quick. HAV Blue, F-117A, Tacit Blue, B-2 Stealth Bomber, Bird of Prey, that was the Phantom Works Bird of Prey, YF-23, the F-22 Raptor, the U-2 spy plane, the A-12, and the SR-71. That's it. Over 62 years, we've only seen 10 aircraft come into the white world. There is so much more out there, James, that we don't know about. There are so many more black programs flying or that have been shelved and perhaps even scrapped that we don't even know about.
Can you tell the difference between, from a layman's point of view, the regular propulsion methods that we're hearing about, and then go on to the hypersonic? Because I think I'm one of those people that have seen the aurora. If you remember, Michael, back in the day, there was these mysterious skyquakes that were shaking up the ground,
Absolutely.
and they would track a corridor of these skyquakes coming to and from the test site in Nevada that headed out to the ocean. And one fine day, I was in Bakersfield at a rest stop, and I dropped the my car seat into a recliner position because I was going from Northern to Southern California, and I was laying there. And next thing you know, the ground starts shaking. And now
Really?
my rational mind kicks in. I'm thinking, okay, there's a big rig behind me. Something is going on. But I just happened to be tilted in my chair just the right way, so just beneath my driver's side roof out the window, I could see an arrowhead shaped object. It
Really?
was painted desert tan on the underside. Behind it was being trailed by a perfectly circular white smoke ring, and I saw it go like from the corner of my car seat window to the other corner out of sight in seconds. And I go, that must be the aurora or something like it. And so if you could talk a bit about what that propulsion is like
Sure,
before
sure,
getting
sure.
on to the field propulsion and all that stuff.
Yeah, we can talk about that. That's a really interesting story because this is something that Bill Scott had been tracking for decades, like an entire career. And credit has to go to Bill for breaching that subject. Now, the way I understand it, and I've tried to follow this as well, is after the Challenger explosion on January 28th, 1986, there was a what they call a lack of aerospace assets. The United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, they lost their what they called assured access to space. That's the actual terminology they use, assured access to space. Now, that's because 70% of payloads on the shuttle were classified DoD cargo. They were sky keyhole satellites from the NRO, the NSA, and other assets. And when the Challenger blew up, they were out of business. So a desperate call went out to the defense contractors, including Lockheed, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, and Rockwell, to build a rapid response two-stage to orbit space plane that could deliver a military payload like rapidly, extremely quickly, and also depleted uranium rods, which are called rods from God, and synthetic aperture radar, very high resolution. That was kind of the goal of this program. So it looks like McDonnell Douglas was hired on to build the parasitic aircraft, which was called Speedy or XOV, the experimental orbital vehicle. And the other aircraft is believed to have been a Lockheed Rockwell aircraft. That's the mothership called the SR-3. Boeing was involved for final assembly. Now that's 200 feet in length, and it has a 120 foot wingspan. And just to go over some of the propulsion systems here. Now you're right, when you were talking about those skyquakes, I've got some USGS reports in my files here. Here's one report, 11/21/91. There was a boom, and then less than a minute later, another boom. That might have been a chase aircraft following it behind. We've got a report here, Catalina Island. This is 6:58 a.m. on April 16th, 1992. Another seismic boom, and this is an airquake, not an earthquake. We'll do one more here, Mount Wilson, April 16th, 1992. Another boom at 7:02 in the morning. Now, these were always on a Thursday morning and always the last Thursday of the month. So it looks like they had a pattern of doing that. And from what I've been told, that's because Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday is for pre-flight. Thursday's the test flight. Friday, there's debrief. And Saturday, Sunday, there's no one there. So that appears to be the case from the 80s to mid to late 1990s, as far as how they were doing the test flights. Now, getting back to the Black Star program, it looks like they ended up building perhaps two motherships and maybe three or perhaps four of the parasitic aircraft. There are multiple eyewitnesses who have seen this in person. I spoke to three people who actually saw it. We'll start with the small one. Again, that was called the XOV, Experimental Orbital Vehicle. It has a length of 60 to 65 feet. It's airdropped from the SR-3 at 90,000 feet. It has a Q bay. It has the four linear aerospike engines that are grouped in two banks at the rear of the aircraft. The top speed is Mach 20. That's around 17,500 miles an hour. Altitude 150 to 250 miles, operated by the CIA or NRO. The bottom of this aircraft is composed of what appear to be space shuttle thermal resistant tiles. And it also has these 1 foot by 1 foot channels that are machined into the bottom. And we think this is to increase the strength of the aircraft. It has a very interesting landing gear configuration. There's a primary skid, and then there's two outrigger wheels, and then there's a conventional nose gear arrangement that retracts forward. And now this thing was actually seen at Holloman Air Force Base in February of 1994. There appears to have been some type of an incident at Kadena Air Force Base in February 12th, 13th, 1994, and this thing was flown back to Holloman. Now let's get into the other craft, which is the mothership. That's the large 200-foot-long craft. This was seen by three people that I've spoken to. Now, this is a carrier for the XOV. We believe it's powered by six Pratt & Whitney J93 engines. Ceiling is 150,000 feet. First flight was in 1988 after Challenger. And the most interesting point about this particular aircraft is it has canards that have winglets on the canards. And these winglets, from what we've been told, is that these canards retract forward as well. But probably the most interesting part of this aircraft is that it has an understructure that has a relief section or a cavity built into the bottom of this craft where the parasitic aircraft can sit up inside. So the pilot would be kind of in the blind all the way to the drop zone, and then they would drop him, and then he'd go over to the site where he wants to monitor what was going on. So this was the Black Star program. It was March 2006 is when it finally broke by Bill Sweetman, and we believe that this program has been shelved since could have been late 90s when it was shelved, but that's the Black Star program in a nutshell.
These craft are, some of them are described as hypersonic. And
Yep.
what does that mean, hypersonic?
Anything over Mach 5.
Anything over Mach 5. And Jim Goodall talked about, and you were kind enough to put his interviews up on your Facebook page. He talked about one of these black aircraft going at least Mach 8.
It's well within the reason. He was at Kelly Johnson's lecture early on, I think it was 83, and Kelly said basically, speed costs money, how fast do you want to go? They already had the technology. It's strictly a money issue. The technology was there. They know how to do it. It's just, do you want to spend the money? Do the contractors, do the American taxpayer want to spend that kind of money to do it? They can do it, and they probably have done it. It's crazy to think that the Blackbird is still the fastest aircraft
Yes.
after all this time. You know they've got other things. Now, I want to talk about at least one of those that I don't think has really ever been talked about before. I want to cover some new ground here.
Oh, please.
So, we've just talked about Black Star. Now, there's another aircraft out there that appears to be, it's probably not Black Star. It must be something else. I don't know what it is, but we've got some data on it. Now, this is United Flight 934 sighting August 5th, 1992. This was a 747 from LAX to London, and the sighting took place near George Air Force Base at 1:45 p.m. The 747 was on a magnetic 40-degree heading, and the pilot saw this, the co-pilot saw this. They were at 23,000 feet. They reported a near collision with this craft.
Whoa.
It was a fast mover. It was going at least triple the normal cruise rate, and It's kind of hard to describe. The best way to describe this is if you took the SR-71 and took the first third of it and chopped it with a meat cleaver, that's what it would look like. Take the first third of the Blackbird, including those forward chines, and then just chop it, and then put two vertical stabilizers slightly canted inward, and then take the pilot's compartment and move it very forward, and then take two F-117 stealth fighter air inlets and put it in back of the crew compartment on either side. That's what this aircraft looked like. Kind of a teardrop SR-71 configuration, and it was reported. It was even in the newsletter for United, so they know it's true. This bird has never been really discussed at all. It's off the radar. This is another one of those black programs we don't know about.
Now, this thing, it had not gotten up to speed, or was the pilot, it was his visual acuity such that, when this thing whizzed by, he still was able to make out these details.
Yep, the co-pilot saw it too. Now, that's all they said. There was no other information provided. It kind of had a cross section of a diamond, and it says the object was reported as looking like a lifting body configuration or the forward fuselage of an SR-71 without wings. According to the
Wow.
pilots, the craft measured approximately 49 feet in length. I tend to trust the credibility of airline pilots. Now, if they said they saw this thing, I totally believe it.
Yeah, I agree. I
I totally
agree.
believe it. It was reported in Aviation Week as well.
Now, one of the other craft that I've seen, which I believe is man-made, I was living in Bullhead City at the time, and I was out in my backyard working out. Due north is Laughlin, further north is Vegas, and then northwest, of course, is the test site. And coming down from the direction generally of the test site was at pretty high altitude and at a rapid clip was a large triangular. In daytime, it appeared to be white from the underside, and this thing, it covered a lot of ground, flew over my head before too long. Now, there's been a lot of talk about, I forget the technical term for TR-3B or something like that,
Sure.
and I'm sure that there are various sizes of these things. What's your take on the reports of the triangular shaped craft? Because also in the Santa Clara Valley in the early 1990s, as well as in San Diego in the mid late 90s, I saw some of these triangular shaped craft. From the side, they look kind of beveled. Underneath, you would see, like in the corners, three round white lights. Sometimes, I guess, in stealthy mode, they would turn off the lights or only have one. And then in the center, you would have this glowing red circular light. What do your sources say about, I'd like to hear what else you've got to say about the other craft you wanted to mention, but
Sure,
just
sure.
about these triangular craft. Well, what's your take and what do your sources say about them?
Okay, well, I certainly agree with you regarding the triangles. I want to cover a little bit of new ground on this as well. Now, this came from Bill Scott as well. This was a report that was received, took place east of Bend, Oregon, August 5th, 1990. There was a KC-135 tanker, estimated altitude somewhere between 10 and 20,000 feet. And eyewitness reported that this KC-135 was going down just their normal vector. And behind the KC-135, there was a flying wing triangular shaped craft, a much more conventional craft than what you mentioned previously. The wing sweep angle appeared to be similar to the F-117, but the trailing edge, it was completely different than the F-117, but still within the triangle configuration. Now, just to the right of the triangle directly behind the KC-135, there was another triangle identical to the first one. But what was weird is the right wingtip of this aircraft appeared to be trailing some type of smoke. We don't know what it was, flames or smoke or something. There must have been some kind of a problem here. But this was another report of what appears to be one of our conventionally powered black aircraft because they were being refueled. It appears to be by this tanker here, and there was some type of problem. That's all we have, but this is another one of these black triangle sighting configurations. Now, getting back to what you wanted to discuss, we have to give credit to David Marler in his book Triangular UFOs. He's probably the world's premier expert on the triangles. He did graciously provide me with a few cases that were never made it into the book, which I want to highlight here. He has one case which I find it fascinating. I just love this case. This was August 25th, 1990, near Barnsley, England. Now, this is by a retired police officer who had 30 years of experience in the field, credible eyewitness. They were coming out of a Fleetwood Mac music concert around 11:50 p.m., so it was late at night. It was the husband and wife. The wife was sleeping in the passenger seat, and they were driving down the road here. And off to the left, not too high at all, coming out of this black misty cloud was a 200 to 300 foot per side black flying triangle, had a white light at each corner, one light in the center, which was indented up into the craft. Uh-huh. And then there was a relief section on the bottom of the craft that had this crossbeam and girder construction like a truss bridge. And that's very important because we've seen the same understructure on the 1989-1990 Belgium Triangle case. We've seen the same structure on the 1983 to 1989 Hudson Valley Boomerang case. So we're seeing this pattern recognition. He provided a two-page report on this entire sighting, extremely reliable. And I'm not going to read the whole report, but just let me read you this one quick sentence here. This is the gentleman talking who saw this. He said, the side of the craft appeared to have several illuminated windows, and at one of the windows, I saw two to three figures that appeared to be human. Certainly nothing about the figures made me think they were anything other than human, reinforcing my belief that the craft was a military project. I could see one of the figures either pointing or waving in my direction. And then this thing went back into that misty cloud and was gone. I mean, this is a credible case. He provided a two-page report and a sketch. And it's legit. It's legit. He's not the only one. Other people have seen these things as well. So I agree with you.
And
they're flying these things.
The ones that I saw in the Santa Clara Valley, I was in the schoolyard, actually the grassy field next to the schoolyard in San Jose, California. And this was about 2, 3 a.m. in the morning. And I saw a few of them. And I would say 90 feet from point the nose to the tailing end, roughly the shape of a triangle. I heard directly, standing directly beneath it, I heard a slight electrostatic sound, if that means anything.
There you go.
And the thing about it, Michael, if I hadn't heard that electrostatic sound, I would never have bothered looking up because they were there. And like I said, some of them had all three lights in the corners going. Some only had like one or two lights, like two lights in the back, or alternatively one at the front end and then one at the back. But they all had that red glowing circular light in the center. And aside from the ones that were making that electrostatic sound, the other ones, near as I could tell, were silent. There was mysterious black helos flying around at that same time. It was an interesting evening.
Wow. You mentioned that electrical humming noise. That is a telltale sign. That's the same thing that people heard in the Belgium Triangle case, Hudson Valley Boomerang case. They describe it as being an electrical humming noise like a transformer or a sewing machine.
Yes.
The same type sound over and over and over again. So when you put this all together, we're dealing with a man-made technology. Now, how can we say that? Because one reason is people who were in the Hudson Valley saw what they call the Westchester Wing.
Yes.
And people that saw this craft said that when the lights went off, they weren't just haphazard. The red lights would flash, the blue lights would flash, the green lights would flash, the yellow whites lights would flash, and then the white lights would flash. And this would all be done in sequence. It was a pattern. So here we're just, again, we're reinforcing the belief that this is a man-made technology. This is not an alien technology. And they want to use the alien card as a cover to hide their own deep black programs. And that's what you see on the supermarket checkout when you go to the National Enquirer. That's the role these guys play.
I've seen a number of these triangular craft of various sizes. One time, ironically, after an alien abduction support group meeting in San Diego, which I was hosting, I stepped outside. I lived in a canyon in Claremont, which is a suburb of San Diego, and flying towards me from the general direction, actually coming seemingly straight from, there's an underground facility known as Site 31. It's in the general vicinity of of Poway. For those people that are from San Diego County, they know where Poway is, which is right next to what used to be Naval Air Station Miramar, which is now a Marine Corps air station. Anyway, it's well known that there is an underground facility there. I've investigated the place. I've seen the huge air ducts and stuff. Anyway, this smaller triangular craft slowly flew towards me, flew over the cul-de-sac that I was at. I had a good view of it for about 9, 10, 11 seconds. The sides of it, there was like a row of lights. It looked like, what someone would call a scout craft. So they seem to have various sizes and could, and probably for different purposes of these things.
Another good case to discuss really quickly here too is the January 5th, 2000 case. Worldwide headlines was cited in southern Illinois, not too far from St. Louis, in Highland, Lebanon, Summerfield, Shiloh, Millstatt, DuPont, O'Fallon. These are the areas it was seen. At least three, what we appear to be three different triangular configurations, and one that looked like a single-story ranch house with a penthouse on top with lighted windows. That was seen by eyewitness Melvin Knoll. Now, let me just read you really quickly here. This is from the Collinsville Journal the next day, January 6, 2000. And it says, object in sky draws interest of UFO researchers. Officer says, now this is Craig Stevens, officer says he is 98% sure object was a experimental or military project. And then he describes the sighting that he was able to be a part of here when this thing was hovering basically over his head. What he says here is Officer Stevens stated that the craft tried to camouflage itself against the night sky and was projecting the star field above it on the underside.
Interesting.
So there you go. They're using electrochromic panels and they're taking what's above the craft, electronically transferring to what's below the craft, essentially allowing it to blend in with the background. And so you could see the star field on the bottom of this craft. It's a brilliant technology. It's brilliant, but it's a man-made technology. There's nothing alien here that we're dealing with.
Yeah, the concepts of electrogravitics, field propulsion, etc., were well known for some time. People like T. Townsend Brown, John Searle, and the poor guy got a lot of harassment back in the day. Now, one of the key places where a lot of this development takes place, Michael, is the infamous Antelope Valley, also known as Aerospace Valley, where there's a number of facilities there: Air Force Plant 42, the Lockheed so-called Hellendale facility. It's got a connection with the Edwards Air Force Base operations. Could you tell our listeners the significance of the Palmdale, Lancaster areas and how it dovetails with places like Area 51, White Sands, etc.?
Yeah, sure. Be glad to. I think, as a bigger picture here, we have to consider what's called Aerospace Alley. That's a terminology they use, and that is from San Diego up the freeway on the highway there, going into Hawthorne, the LA Basin,
Oh,
and then
yes.
continuing on to Burbank, which used to be Lockheed Skunk Works, and then moving up and then onto the 14th toward Lancaster, Palmdale. That gets you to Air Force Plant 42, where Boeing has a lab there, Northrop has a facility there, and of course Lockheed has a facility there. Rockwell, they built a shuttle there, continuing on to Edwards Air Force Base and then terminating in Mojave at Scale Composites. So that really is the heart of the military industrial complex, or what's known as Aerospace Alley. But if you really wanted to narrow it down, James, you're absolutely correct. It is Air Force Plant 42. All roads lead to that place because Plant 10, Lockheed is there, the Skunk Works is there. This is where the magic is happening. A lot of times they build sub-assemblies in the Los Angeles area, and then they're trucked or flown from their facility up to Plant 42 for final assembly. And if it's really big, then final assembly takes place at the remote test site in Nevada. But you're absolutely correct. Plant 42, Palmdale, Lancaster, that's the heart of the military industrial complex.
Now, the composites they use and the alloys they use, could you talk a bit about the construction of the craft, the external hull? For example, it's well known that the SR-71 had a titanium frame, right, to be able to, absorb all the friction and stuff from the atmosphere. What are the metals and alloys that are being utilized to create these craft these days?
Well, certainly titanium was used to build the SR-71. Now, to this day, it's still classified what the radar absorbent materials on the F-117 are composed of. But you know right off the bat, it's a toxic chemical, it's a toxic
Yes.
material. We know that because every Thursday, there was a 18-wheeler tractor trailer that loaded 55-gallon drums of solvent, epoxies, resin, radar absorbent material, waste, and other toxic material, put on these 55-gallon drums, and then driven all the way from Burbank. This happened every week on a Thursday, I think, all the way from Burbank to Area 51, and then these gallons, these 55-gallon drums, were offloaded into these big trenches at Area 51, and then gasoline and diesel fuel was poured on these drums, and then they just lit a flare and threw it into that pit, and the whole thing just set up blaze completely. And these 55-gallon drums would probably explode, and all this acrid black smoke would be hovering over Area 51, right over the residential area where all the engineers were sleeping. And that's why all these lawsuits got going, because these guys were inhaling this toxic smoke. Now, for the life of me, I can't figure out why they would do that, but it was done. And to this day, those safety data sheets, which compose the material involved in the radar absorbent materials, has not been talked about. The judge has waived it, and so there's no help for those engineers.
Yes, because one of the I remember when this story first broke,
Yep.
part of the stumbling block was they didn't even want to admit that that facility existed out there, because it would open a whole can of worms of what were all these contractors doing there. What, you throw occupational safety and health out the window doing what they're
Right.
doing. I mean, it's a huge class action lawsuit just waiting to happen.
I mean, in the end, stealth is great, but it's very labor intensive,
Yes.
at least the first generation of stealth, because you had to make sure that every screw head was aligned properly. It had to be down secured perfectly, or the RCS of the aircraft went way up. You had to use fillers and putties, and there was maintenance after each flight, and it was like maintenance on this thing was a disaster. I've got one story from Jim Goodall. When the B-2 was first coming online, after getting released from the Palmdale Air Force Plant 42 Northrop facility, that's the final assembly building over at Plant 42, and it was flown to Whiteman very early on in the program, they would bring it into the hangar, and then they would shut the hangar door, and overnight, they just let it sit overnight, and then the next morning when they opened the door to get into the hangar, Jim told me that every living creature in that hangar was dead on the floor
My goodness.
because of the toxicity of the RAM and other chemicals used in the formation of that material was just so volatile that it killed everything in there. So dealing with these RAM materials is harmful to your health to the at the very least.
Yeah, for the listeners, RAM is, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, radar absorbent material.
Correct. That's right.
Another thing that people ask about is there are certain areas that are notorious for this kind of research and development engineering. We just talked about Antelope Valley and the aerospace alley, but what other bases are known to have harbored or perhaps based some of these craft? You talk about Kadena in Okinawa. You talked about
Right.
what and also England, because Bascom Down, RAF Bascom Down, and
Yes.
other places are alleged to have harbored these craft.
Spooky things are alleged to have taken place at Edwards North Base Complex. There is some evidence to support the conclusion that there were some things going on at MacDill Air Force Base. Something probably took place at Cannon Air Force Base, Holloman Air Force Base, Tonopah Test Range in Nevada, not too far from Area 51, where the F-117s were stationed early on. Certainly, Tonopah Test Range would be a location. So that's just a few other locations where these things are going on.
And we also know, at least from a surface level, especially with the hindsight of history, we have movies that come out, The Right Stuff, yada yada yada, about how they selected and how they trained a lot of the people in the early X-Craft programs and the early astronaut programs. How does these programs, these SAPs, go about recruiting the pilots and you know the engineers and the crew? You know, I'm talking about the flight maintenance people out there on, you know, in these facilities.
I think there's two ways to answer that. There are company proprietary test pilots, and then there's U.S. Air Force test pilots that come out of the U.S. Test Pilot School at Edwards Air Force Base. But Lockheed has their own pilots that they use, and then many times the U.S. Air Force just use some of their very, very expert pilots to fly these things. But you have to be the best of the best. You have to be the best of the best. You don't ask to be on these programs. You are, well, you get chosen to be. You can't ask to be on these things. You have to be invited in on this, as they say in the black world. And that's true for the engineers as well. You can't ask yourself to be invited. You have to be personally invited on these programs. That's what I've been told anyway.
And from what I understand, some of the engineers that live around Palmdale, Lancaster, they're flown in these so-called Janet flights to the Nevada test site and other places, and you know they're harbored there, and then they do their work, and then they fly them back home. Or and some of them, I imagine, live in the Vegas area as well.
Yep, that's correct. That's still going on today. One program that may have a connection, and we can talk about this really quick, is the Belgium Triangle that was sighted November 7th and 29th of 1989 and March 30th of 1990, where thousands of people in the Belgium area reported these black triangles that were hovering that the size of a football field. They had a light at each corner, one red light that was revolving in the center, and then what looked like tubes, pipes, and cylinders on the bottom of this craft. It was making a low-frequency electrical humming noise, and it went from 280 kilometers per hour to 1,800 kilometers per hour in less than 1 second, which is equivalent to 40 Gs. So they have mastered this mass-canceling concept of eliminating G forces. They have made a breakthrough. There was no sonic boom at all. So when we hear about black programs and things that are 50 years beyond what we can even comprehend, they've made the breakthrough. They've absolutely made the breakthrough. A couple of quick terms I want to use here is when you think about these black programs, they actually have three terms they use. Number one is called ace in the hole technology. Number two is called trump card technology. Number three is called silver bullet technology. So if they really have something that they want to accomplish, they will pull one of these aces out of their coat pocket and use that as an asset for a threat that they want to basically eliminate. But they're not pulled out of the hangar for just little wars here and there. These are the big guns that are saved for a different type of warfare.
Is there any indication that Russia or China or some other nation is working along similar lines? You know, field propulsion, electrogravitics. We know that stealth, at least the initial stages in the research, a lot of that came from the Russians to begin with, and then it was perfected by the Americans. But as far as the kind of craft we've been discussing, is there any indication the Russians, for example, have been doing the same thing?
I think they have been doing a similar line of research, but not to the level as America's done. I don't think they have the technology quite up to where it needs to be to get to where we are. And the only reason why I can say that is because when the F-117 was brought on, even their best radars could not track it properly. For them to actually make even the slightest attempt to track the F-117, they would have to retrofit their entire radar ranges at the cost of billions to the Soviet Union. So they just couldn't do it. We spent them into submission. They just couldn't keep up with it. By the time the F-117 went operational, what could they do at that point? There's nothing more they could do. So it was a done deal right there. They may have some stealth programs that we don't know about, but I just don't think it's to the level that we're at right here.
When you mentioned earlier about these large motherships, am I correct in understanding that they would put certain payloads on board some of these larger craft, fly them way up, you know, probably near the top of the atmosphere, and then release these things, vice sending them out the old-fashioned way out of Vandenberg or Cape Canaveral, some other place, to launch satellites. They would launch these military payloads from these craft. Is that what's going on?
That appears to be what's going on. The Speedy XOV has what's called a Q bay, and from what Bill Scott told me, it could be used to launch a military satellite. It could carry a synthetic aperture radar, or it could launch what's called a rod from God, which is a depleted uranium round that doesn't have any explosive on it. It's just a sheer velocity weapon. At that speed, if you can launch that thing at that speed, you don't need any
Yeah.
warhead on board. It's just the sheer velocity alone is so destructive. So those are the three missions that this thing can carry out.
And the kinetic impact of this alone would just slaughter anything it hits. Now,
Yep.
from your understanding and what your sources are telling you, about how many of these experimental craft, and actually it's a misnomer because we've just been talking about some of these must be operational by now, about how many of these programs are going on at the Nevada test site at this time?
Okay. From what I've been told, when you talk about an X plane, like an X-40 or an X-50 or maybe an X-80, if there are twice as many X planes as being reported. So when you hear about an X-50, we're already at an X-100. And that's what it was told to me. So we have so many more things out there that we don't know about. Just in the Reagan administration alone, there were dozens of manned programs that have not even seen the light of day. And there's no doubt about it. Whether we'll ever get to see those is unknown. Some of these were failures and they crashed and were buried at Area 51, never to see human eyes again. That could be the result of some of these programs.
Now, as far as operationally, we know that, for example, the most advanced Russian air defense system, I think it's the S-400. To this day, that cannot, from your understanding, paint an F-117 and lock onto it for any length of time. Is that the case?
Probably so even today. I mean, it's first generation stealth technology, but it was still good for its time. They may have a different system now to track F-117s, even though they've been retired. So apparently the F-22 is taking over a lot of that role, but I still think there's things out there other than the F-22 that are even more stealthy than the F-22. There's got to be other assets, other flying wings. We seem to have this gap between the fighter and the bomber, between the F-22 and the B-2 stealth bomber. We need some kind of medium range
Yes,
bomber. And
yes.
so there must be some blank spot that they have filled that we don't know about. It just seems logical that'd be the case.
Now, several years back, if you remember, there was this interesting crash retrieval, seemingly a crash retrieval operation that happened at near my old stomping grounds of Bullhead City. They even talked about this in the Coast to Coast show, where some kind of turquoise or aqua colored object, like hit the ground or hit the water and kind of bounced along and came to grief somewhere along the Colorado River there, because I lived in Bullhead City, just across the Colorado River was Laughlin, Nevada, mini Vegas for those of you in the know, and I had a friend that lived right there along the Colorado River, and he said for days after this alleged incident there were like helos going up and down the waterway there, looking for something. They were like in a search pattern. Have you heard anything about that particular crash retrieval? Because that seems to me to have been the crash of one of these craft that are developed in a place like Bombdale.
I have heard about that. I can't say I'm completely familiar with that case, but it's another good example of a military retrieval. You could even go back to December 29th, 1980 at Huffman, Texas, the Cache Landrum incident
Yes.
where same type helicopters were, I don't know, they were Chinook CH-23s where they had the double rotors, and then there was a couple of Hueys and one sky crane apparently was there as well, and they were shepherding that craft. And that's not the first time that helicopters have been involved as well. There's others prior to Cache Landrum as well, so there's a military involvement in these. There's no doubt about it, and they have a handle on this, and we just are not being told for multiple reasons. Some of them might be legit, but when you have a program that's 40 to 50 years old, where it represents no threat to national security, there's no reason why they should keep it classified.
And there's a notion, and I think there's something to this, that ultimately, the proprietary ownership of at least some of these craft that are developed, they're in private, i.e., corporate hands. So, I mean, the military may provide some of the pilots, but ultimately, it's these corporations that own these craft. Is that correct?
Yep. Well, when it comes to the Boeing Phantom Works Bird of Prey, which was declassified October 2002 during the Bush administration, that was a Boeing proprietary program, and so they paid for it with their own money, and that makes it exempt from FOIA requests. So you really can't get anything more on Bird of Prey. But for the other ones, like HAVBLUE, F-117, B-2 Stealth Bomber, and other black programs, you're absolutely right. The Air Force is nothing more than a temporary custodian for those assets. We own the planes, we own the facilities, we owned all the hangars, we own the we basically own the people who are paid with our tax dollars. Their salary is coming from us, so we own those assets. They don't. They're nothing but temporary custodians for those. So we have every right to question authority.
And the whole notion of the black budget, Michael, is something that people need to be aware of, because it seems to me that the money and the resources of the surface world is being plowed into these SAPs, special access programs, and as Ben Rich says, they don't see the light of day. So the resources of the surface world are being transferred down into these black budgets through these umbrella projects, and then they get allocated to all these projects, and we simply don't benefit from them.
Nope.
And also, you talk about the potential benefit it would have to for us as far as travel and whatnot. Also, it would take a load off all of the ecological damage that's being meted out to our planet through basically the harvesting of petroleum and everything out of the ground. I mean, that's another reason I feel why this cover up is maintained, is they simply don't want to give us this technology because it would upset the apple cart, so to speak.
You're right. And that doesn't even include the black programs that we don't know of that were failures that cost taxpayers billions as well. There's got to be dozens of those out there that are completely black. Good example is A-12 Avenger 2 that was canceled in 1990 by Dick Cheney at the cost of $5 billion to taxpayers. So now, according to Bill Scott, a portion of that money may have gone on to Blackstar. They charged some of that program to Blackstar program. You could see where that is, but we've got nothing to show for the A-12 Avenger 2 after $5 billion blown on it. It's just a total waste, and that's just the ones we know about. There's so many more out there that we don't know about. And you're right, it's about the technology, it's about the propulsion system, how it could relate to the civil air industry, what airliners could do with this technology. It would only be like a $10 flight from Los Angeles to New York. They couldn't charge you $500 anymore. They'd only charge you $10. So the commercial industry would be completely upset if this came out. And we're just using dinosaur technology that's 70 years old. It's just terrible.
Yeah, thrust propulsion, just polluting the environment and all the dangers to the passengers flying at altitude like that, and let alone the flight crews, to be subjected to the radiation, solar radiation, day after day, in their duties. In the time we got left, Michael, one thing I'd like to ask you is, somehow or other, you came across at least some of the files and the paperwork of the late great Leonard Stringfield. And for the benefit of my listeners, Leonard Stringfield was a pioneering UFO researcher, formerly with the 5th Air Force in New Guinea during World War II in the Philippines. He was an intelligence officer. He had his own sighting of UFOs, I think, off of Aishima or something, when he was in a cargo plane headed, I think, to Japan. But in the years after World War II, he became a UFO investigator, and he pioneered what we now refer to as the research into UFO crash retrievals. And so, and unfortunately, Len Stringfield passed away some years ago, but I always thought of him as a pioneer in the field. If he's in my personal pantheon of great researchers. So I'd like you to tell how you came into possession of some of his papers, and also, What case or cases really stand out from your
Yeah.
perusal of these archives?
Great, great. Be glad to do it. First thing I want to state is, personally, on my end, I could never prove beyond a shadow of a doubt with physical evidence that a lot of these crash retrieval cases were authentic. Even Leonard couldn't, to be honest, as well. He couldn't land the plane, so to speak, because he just didn't have the physical evidence to lock up the case. But he had a heck of a lot of good sources, and there was a lot of smoke, and there could have been some fire there. But again, there was no absolute 100% conclusive proof. Now, just to go back to what you were talking about, it was in 1977 that Leonard gave his first lecture on crash retrievals, basically retrievals of the third kind. And
Yes.
it was a revolution. It was something completely brand new back then. It caused a lot of commotion. There was a backlash involved. There was questioning. It really rocked the boat of ufology back then. And at the end of his presentation, as the story goes, Leonard just said, if you or someone you know has any first-hand eyewitness reports dealing with craft and bodies that were recovered, first-hand dealing eyewitness testimony or people who've actually held the debris, please contact me. And he left a mailing address. And then he and his wife, Dell, went out to a 2-week vacation. And so they got back from the vacation 2 weeks later and they went to the post office. He opened up his mailbox. It was totally empty. There was nothing there. So he was like discouraged, thinking there was nothing to this. No one really cared. He looked back just one more time before he was going to close his safety deposit box there, and there was a little slip. And he pulled out the slip and he turned it over and it said, "See Postmaster." So he walked up with that slip up to the postmaster, handed it to the postmaster, and the person said, "I'll be back in a few minutes." About 5 minutes later, there were two large men carrying these massive mail sacks over their shoulders. There were about 10,000 letters
Wow.
to Leonard Stringfield. It was a massive response that was just unbelievable. And that was really the beginning of the hunt for these things. It had gone on a couple of years before then, but that was when it really took off. Leonard passed away in 1994. His files are still in Ohio, not accessible to anyone on this planet, which seems a waste at this point because it's been
Yes.
so long now. A lot of those witnesses are dead and an opportunity has been lost. But the dictation notes from Leonard Stringfield were donated a few years ago to MUFON headquarters in Southern California. And I was able to be fortunate enough to gain access to that collection by the MUFON board of directors. And I spent about 3 solid days, good 10-hour days, going through all 75 binders. And from those 75 binders, I was able to retrieve a good 3-ring binder that it was about 5 inches thick, which is the primary core of my book called Retrievals of the Third Kind: Cosmic Crashes, Corpses, and Cover-ups. And that's the genesis of this book that is based on Leonard's material. He has to get credit. Now, as we're winding down here, I want to talk about at least one of these cases in his files that I think has the best chance of being true. Now, this is December 1963. This is a Marine personnel who was a guard, and he, back in 1963, he was summoned at Cherry Point, North Carolina, to board an airliner with blacked-out windows. So he gets on this airliner, and they travel for about 2 hours. He doesn't know where this was. They don't. He does to this day. He does not know where they landed. All he knows is they took off from Cherry Point. They flew for 2 hours, landed at an undisclosed location. When they got to this undisclosed location, they pull open up this like hangar door, and what they found was a 40-foot diameter hamburger-shaped UFO that was propped up on wooden crates, kind of, and then built all around this craft was like building scaffolding that you could walk around like a catwalk, but they had scaffolding completely enclosing this thing. It was 40 feet in diameter, 15 feet tall, a polished aluminum metallic surface with kind of opaque or frosty windows that you could not see inside. And these windows had a 1-inch lip or gap on them, kind of a strange lip. And there was a number of locations where they had tried to gain entry into this craft. Right around the seam of the door was four locations where they tried to drill in. I think they tried diamond tip drills. They tried air handles. They tried chisels, every possible thing. They tried lasers to get in this thing. To no avail. They were not able to get in this thing. Now, painted on the floor directly below this 40-foot diameter craft was a white ring that they painted. Anyone who was heading toward that ring and would breach that white ring was told to be shot on site, no questions asked.
Wow.
And there was a naval admiral that was walking up to this thing who almost got shot because he just about crossed that line. So basically, he was guarding this craft for 2 weeks. And as I mentioned, they couldn't gain access to this thing. They tried using these high-powered lasers, and there were two 18-wheeler tractor trailers parked outside this facility that had these two thick cables that provided the power source for this laser. And basically, all that happened when they put the laser on this is it bounced off the craft and started cooking the material on the ceiling, which was the basis for some of the movie called Hangar 18 that was released years ago.
I remember it, yeah.
Yep. That was based off of this incident, from what we can tell. After 2 weeks, this gentleman, he went back to the hangar one more time for a guarding session, and all he saw was this thing propped up on a trailer with tarpaul covering it and then chains covering that, and this thing was being trucked to another location. So it was never at any location for any length of time because they kept on moving it so you couldn't track it, and that's happening on these other retrievals as well. But the interesting point about this is this particular Marine, he took a photo of this thing.
Oh, he did.
He took a photo of it. Yeah, he did. He did. Unfortunately, that photo was lost in a flood, but he did take a photo of it, and we were that close to getting this bombshell evidence that we've been looking for all this time. It's always one step ahead. It's always one step ahead. Now, I've tried to track down this guy. I have not been able to track him down. I think he's still alive, but I believe his story. This is the most pertinent case within the Stringfield files that I think has some authenticity to it. He was just a Marine. He was an MP guarding things. He was pulled off duty. He was told to guard this thing for 2 weeks. He did see it. There were other people there who were guarding it as well. He talked about the scaffolding. He talked about the crates. I've got some of the original notes that were done with the interviewer who did a 2-hour interview with me when I saw him. This was 2 years ago. I think it's a real case, and we were so close to breaking it, but it's gone. It's gone. And now these cases are 30, 35, and 40 years old. We're really racing the Undertaker like Stan talks about. We've literally got months to years left, and these things will be lost to history.
Yeah, some of these witnesses need to be debriefed.
Yes, they do.
Get videotaped depositions out of them before it's
too
late.
Yes, they do. Yes, so, they do.
Well, thank you for coming on the show, Michael. It's been
no problem.
Really, really enlightening, and we'd love to have you on sometime in the future.
Sure, that sounds great.
To all our dear listeners out there, wherever you may be, whatever you may be doing, please have a very pleasant time, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.